Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week we discuss a new biography of reggae star Bob Marley.
In America, his audience was, interestingly enough, more among a white audience than an African-American one. He was very big with the rock and roll crowd.
The Times' writer-at-large Charles McGrath is here to talk about a remarkable new memoir by bioterrorism expert Jessica Stern. The Strange Case of Elliot Spitzer. There are two new books about him.
I think there's regret for Elliot Spitzer for a lot of things, but I get the sense that he feels that he has more to give, that perhaps he stepped off the stage too quickly.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. Almost 30 years after his death, Bob Marley remains a figure of fascination, and he's the subject of a new biography. It's called Bob Marley, The Untold Story. It's by Chris Salowish. It's reviewed for us by Boz Dreisinger, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Boz.
Thank you.
Bob Marley is a famous figure. The story's often been told, but briefly, what are the outlines of his career?
Bob started out, he was born in the country in Jamaica, eventually moved to a famous area of Kingston called Trenchtown, where there was a burgeoning music scene. And right about the time that Jamaica became independent, Bob's musical career took off with the Wailers. He signed on to work with a number of the legendary artists and producers in Jamaica at that time, Cox and Dodd, of Studio One being the most notable. And he also is very famous for having several managers who took him to an overseas market, Danny Sims being one of them and Chris Blackwell of Island Records being another. Over that, the course of those years in the 60s up through the 70s, he eventually went solo and left the Wailers behind. And also became wrapped up with a number of the politicians at the time. For instance, in 1971, he played as part of the PNP, People's National Party's bandwagon. One of the stories in this biography claims that Michael Manley, at the time, who was the candidate, had said he would legalize marijuana if in exchange for Bob playing on his bandwagon. So he was caught up with some of the politics there. He's also extremely famous for taking Rastafarianism mainstream. Up until that point in the 60s, in the 50s, Rastafarianism was seen as something on the fringes of society, and Bob certainly made it iconic. Something that people saw and knew about. And his albums are some of the best-selling reggae albums of today.
And what's the story, what's the angle that this new biographer brings to it?
Well, the angle is more and more detail, ultimately. There really isn't a particular angle to the biography other than to tell you more about kind of what we already know. He's a really well-documented subject, obviously. In my review, I call it the Marley Industrial Complex, 'cause he's been covered, over-covered, covered again from every which way. Books by his son, his mother, his wife. So I don't think that there's a specific angle here other than to tell you more of what you already know and to fill in even more details.
But you also say in your review there are some mysteries. For instance, he was almost assassinated, and we don't really know why.
Yeah, we don't know why. We also don't know really the particulars of his death, for instance. He died of a cancer that grew from his toe. We don't know kind of why he wasn't on top of that, why the people around him weren't on top of that situation such that it got out of hand and ultimately killed him. We don't know what happened in the clinic where he was treated in Bavaria with a doctor who was a certified member of the SS. We don't know the full story about those two. Those are the two major aspects of Bob's life and death, really, that we don't know a lot about. And my feeling is that this biography doesn't shed any new particular light on those two great mysteries. But I think the mysteries are part of what make Bob stick around in our consciousness. There's always that big curiosity about the two big questions of his life.
And when did he reach his peak as an artist and performer? I mean, some of us, sadly, are old enough to remember when Bob Marley and reggae really transformed the landscape. Kind of situate all that for us.
The amazing thing is that actually, in many ways, he became as big as he is after he died. Like many artists, Bob struggled to find a great audience during his lifetime. His biggest audience was in Europe in the 70s, places like Sweden. He was beloved and supported. In America, his audience was, interestingly enough, always among a white audience than an African-American one. He was very big with the rock and roll crowd. He opened for Bruce Springsteen in a New York City gig, again, in the 70s. And he found an African-American audience late in his career, in the late 70s. And so in Jamaica, meanwhile, the radio often, for much of his career, never played him, didn't play a tremendous amount of the Wailers even. But it was in the late 70s and then after his death that he was really cemented as this icon whom people listened to.
And why wasn't his music being played in Jamaica? Was the controversy, or was he just not that popular?
No, it just wasn't tremendously popular early on. There were other artists who were. It's just sort of the vagaries of the music industry. Bob also spent a good amount of time overseas. He was in London. He was in the U.S. And so there was always an attention to the international market in a way that wasn't necessarily typical of other reggae artists.
Well, the first time I heard of him was when Eric Clapton had a hit recording by Shot the Sheriff, which I'm guessing was in 74 or something like that. I remember at that time the following was really with white audiences. And you say that for much of his career, that's where it was. And it didn't really change till after his death.
It started to change in the late 70s. He played a tremendous concert in Boston in 79, I think it was, that was primarily for an African-American audience. But, I mean, the Grateful Dead would fly him out to do shows on the West Coast. When he opened for, or I think it was, he performed alongside Sly and the Family Stone again in the mid-70s. There wasn't a tremendous response.
I think I heard him play once, correct me if I'm wrong, with the Commodores. Is that possible? In Madison Square Garden in the 70s?
Yes, that would be possible.
And I was there with my friends to see him. I'm guessing a lot of the audience was white for that, but I don't remember exactly.
Well, because he was marketed as a rock and roll act and not as necessarily a soul act or R&B. It was always about rock and roll. And that was partly, there's a lot of discussion among Marley critics and scholars about why that was so and how much role Chris Blackwell played in that, Chris Blackwell of Island Records. There was a lot of sort of rock and roll sweetening that went on in Catch a Fire, which was his major crossover album, his first album with Chris Blackwell. There's actually a great story in the biography about Wayne Perkins, an Alabama guitarist who plays on Catch a Fire, who was just sort of carried up to the studio to add some kind of country rock and roll effects to the album, and had no idea who Bob Marley was, had no idea who the Wailers were, had no idea what reggae music was, or so he said, but just kind of played along. And a lot of these musicians were never credited on Catch a Fire.
And what about some of the great songs? Are they just part of the repertory now? Do all musicians learn them, play them?
Well, at this point, absolutely. I think it's interesting, too, because a lot of the songs were recorded. Jamaica's such the land of versions in so many ways. It's the land of versions musically, but it's also the land of versions in terms of stories being told again and again, and there are so many different versions of the story. In fact, that's why it's almost fitting that Bob should have several or a whole spate of stories told about him, because Jamaica is very much about that, all that storytelling. There's five different ways of seeing the same event, and you never quite know which version is the truth. There's actually quite a lot of hearsay and takes in this biography. That's where a lot of the quote-unquote factual information comes from, which doesn't surprise me because, again, it's everyone's got their version of events.
Boz, you've mentioned the fixation on Bob Marley, but he didn't come from nowhere. There were other great musicians. There almost always are when a great sound is created. is the fixation, the fascination with Bob Marley kind of blinding us to some of the great artists who were his contemporaries and played with him?
Absolutely. It's not to take away from Bob to say that he grew up in a context. And the other great musicians like Peter Tosh, whom he was in the Wailers with, Jimmy Cliff, who was a superstar before Bob was, in many ways opened the doors for Bob with The Harder They Come, Toots of Toots and the Maytals, Lee Scratch Perry. These are all tremendous names who played a role in Bob's success, but also were incredible artists in their own right. And although there have been books about those men, nowhere near on the level of what we see with Bob.
Well, you know, you remind me, Boz, many years ago, I'm showing my age again, when John Rockwell, who was at the time the lead pop critic at this newspaper, the New York Times, reviewed a Bob Marley concert. He said, well, he's a good songwriter, but only a decent singer, unlike the great Jimmy Cliff.
It's funny because actually it's mentioned that in his first audition, the producer said about Bob, he's an all right singer, but he's a much better dancer.
Thanks a lot, Boz.
Thank you.
That's Boz Dreisinger, who this week reviews Bob Marley, The Untold Story by Chris Salowish.
No sun will shine in my day today.
No sun will shine.
The high yellow moon won't come out to
that
play.
Yellow moon won't come out to play.
I said,
anyone who follows the world of terrorism and counterterrorism may have heard of Jessica Stern, prominent scholar at Harvard who's written widely on the subject. She's also the author of an unusual memoir, and my wonderful colleague Charles McGrath, writer-at-large at the New York Times, has actually written a story about Jessica Stern. Chip, what's the story with her? What makes this book unusual?
She's a sort of world-famous expert on terrorism, who has written about bioterrorism, chemical terrorism, and a book that we reviewed here at the Book Review about 7 years ago about terrorists themselves. She's famous in some circles for being fearless, for being able to go and actually sit down with these people and get them to talk to her. In her new book, she kind of suggests that why she's able to do this is because she herself was the victim of an act of terror. Her book is called Denial, and it's a memoir about how she and her younger sister were, when she was 15, were raped in the town of Concord, Mass. The police bungled the investigation. They didn't believe Stern or her sister. Her father, who happened to be in Europe at the time, didn't even bother to come home. He didn't think it was so serious. And so the two girls, though Jessica more than her sister, went into denial. The whole community went into denial. Concord, not the kind of town where rape happened. So years later, the case got reopened, and she found herself reinvestigating it. She eventually tracked the guy down. He was dead, but it turned out he had raped 44 people, all with the same methodology. So that's fascinating in itself as a kind of cold case aspect to it. But then the other thing is she talks about the effect that the experience had on her, and it created in her this ability, she says, to sort of go numb, to lose feeling. In situations that would make most of us terrified, she experiences an unnatural kind of calm. She says, you know, that writing the book made her realize that becoming an expert in terrorism was not something that happened accidentally, as she once thought, but this is the pattern of her life, that all her life she has been secretly studying violent men and trying to not be afraid of them.
Thanks a lot, Chip. Elliot Spitzer, we can't live with him, we can't live without him. There are two new books about him. One's called Rough Justice, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer. It's by Peter Elkind. And there is The Journal of the Plague Year, an insider's chronicle of Elliot Spitzer's short and tragic reign. It's by Lloyd Constantine. They're both reviewed for us this week by Nicholas Confessori, who knows a lot about Spitzer. He helped break the story of Spitzer's involvement with prostitutes, and he's a reporter in the Albany Bureau of the Times and with us on the phone. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Sam, how are you?
All right. Tell us who Irwin is.
Well, in the telling of one of these two accounts, which is the one written by Peter Alkind, he is a alter ego to Eliot Spitzer, the sort of crazy version of Eliot who would occasionally, you know, peek out in a meeting or with a target of an investigation back in the Attorney General days, the guy who would rage and fulminate, who would lose his temper occasionally, but in their mind was just like an aberration who would pop out once in a while.
Nick, it looked as if Spitzer, just a few short years ago, was on top of the world, brilliant prosecutor, Attorney General, State of New York, swept into power as governor, rising politician. How did he act so recklessly? What happened?
Well, what's very interesting in these books is that they both establish a chronology where Eliot Spitzer began seeing prostitutes when he was still the Attorney General, when he was riding high, when he was the sheriff of Wall Street, potentially the first Jewish president. There were really high hopes for this guy. And so one theory offered by Lloyd Constantine, his former advisor in the administration, is that he became worse and worse at being governor the more he was patronizing prostitutes, that the secret shame, the secret compromising of the trust behind closed doors was driving him to be more and more unreasonable and less adaptable to Albany as he became governor. The second book by Peter Alkind is less introspective in that sense. It doesn't say, here's my theory. It's much more of a straightforward account. But it does have an interview with Eliot Spitzer. And what Eliot Spitzer basically says is, it was convenient. I thought it wouldn't hurt anybody. He suggests that because of the demands of marriage and career, it just seemed like a convenience to him, which is sort of the standard explanation of how rich men end up seeing prostitutes. It's easy and convenient for them, and they have the money.
Nick, what about the future for Spitzer? He's coming back. He's going to be on CNN. Does he have any talent in that direction, as far as you can tell?
I personally believe he's a pretty good television commentator. And one thing, as I've read his columns that he started writing in Slate, the occasional op-ed, you do sort of remember that he has a real mind and he had a real vision of where he wanted to go and where he wanted to bring the state. He had a vision for public policy, for progressive politics. His successor, David Paterson, for whatever his pluses and minuses, seems to evince less of a cohesive vision of where he wants to go. And so I think there's regret for Eliot Spitzer for a lot of things. But I get the sense that he feels that he has more to give. And I think he has the sense that perhaps he stepped off the stage too quickly, that perhaps he's entitled or deserves or can earn another chance to influence public policy, whether as a candidate or as a TV host. There's been talk about him being the controller candidate for New York. That's a possibility, perhaps not this year, perhaps in 4 years. So I think we haven't seen the last of him.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Nicholas Confessori, who this week reviews two books on Eliot Spitzer. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Big news, Sam. Sweden freezes over just in time for the 4th of July. We can declare ourselves free of the tyranny of Scandinavian mystery writers. Glenn Beck has knocked out Stieg Larsson. His new thriller, The Overton Window, enters at number one.
Whoa. So Beck is just like, there must be some law of physics that applies to him. You just can't get in this man's way. You can't stop him.
Yeah, his fingerprints are all over the bestseller list these days. You know, recently he made an Amazon bestseller out of Friedrich Hayek, long dead Austrian economist. This week he can claim some props for another book that pops up on the nonfiction list. It's Larry Schweikart's Seven Events That Made America, America. Larry Schweikart, that name might sound familiar. Earlier this year, Beck gave a little plug to his book, A Patriot's History of the United States, sending it to number one on the paperback list. You may wonder, what are some of these events that made America, America?
Let me guess, the Montgomery bus boycott.
Not exactly. On the other hand, he does have some harsh words for Martin Van Buren and his extension of the federal bureaucracy. And he also has a chapter about Dwight Eisenhower's 1955 heart attack. That was the moment, he thinks, when the federal government started getting interested in telling us what we could eat and drink for the sake of our own good health.
So that's what led to the fascism of universal health care? Is that what he's arguing?
Something like that.
What about the rest of the nonfiction list?
There are a couple new titles. Stuff My Dad Says by Justin Halpern, still at number one, followed by Anthony Bourdain's culinary tell-all Medium Raw. Don't think there's anything in there about Dwight Eisenhower's meat intake. A couple of new titles, both from celebrity land. Tori Spelling is back with her latest Uncharted Territory. Get it? And Furious Love, a book about the epic romance between Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, enters at number 14. So Liz and Dick, Tori and Dean, take your pick.
Sounds hot. Thanks, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.